Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Well, we're concluding the study in Zechariah. And Zechariah 14 is very unique, even though it's part and parcel of the literary unit of 9 through 14. I want to read a bit of my introduction to you. If you have an outline, you can follow with me. And then we'll go to the text of Zechariah 14. There have been two main problems in interpreting this chapter. One is to take it too literal, and the other is to take it in a very allegorical, spiritual sense. Let me say to you that if I did not have the New Testament, some of the details of the life of Christ that are explicated from chapters 9 through 14 of Zechariah, I would have never seen them. Now, that being true of the life of Christ, that leads me to think that the prophecies of the end time are going to be very literal, too. I really think that every age tries to force the Bible into their day. And when they do that, they radically bend the Scripture around. This is a difficult chapter to interpret. I think when the last generation comes, it won't be so difficult. You know, this must have been memorized by Jesus. Chapters 1 through 8 are quoted most often in the book of the Revelation, but chapters 9 through 14 are quoted most often in the Gospels. Jesus must have known this by heart. The two on the road to Emmaus, they must have heard an explication of Zechariah 9 through 14 from the life of Christ. So it is a very, very exciting. It's also very messianic. But this last chapter is not so much messianic as it is God the Father focused. Now, it's an end-time event, but it's what always happens in the Old Testament. They take past or current historical crises and use them to foreshadow future events. It's obvious the whole book of Zechariah is an end-time-oriented book, okay? I really believe that God's still going to use national Israel, Romans 9 through 11. But friends, I want to tell you, he's not going to use them until they turn to him. Now, he may have preserved them because his name's involved. But he's not going to use them in the sense of these prophecies until they turn back to Jesus, whom they've pierced. Now, I don't know if the modern Zionist state is the end time eschatological hope or if there's going to be another. I simply don't know. I do believe that the church has supplemented, complemented, and fulfill the initial task of the nation of Israel, which was to be a kingdom of priests, Exodus 19, 4 through 6. And we see that by the church being used, those very same terms being used for her in 1 Peter 2, 5 and 9, and Revelation 1, 6. Don't be so dogmatic on how you interpret these last few chapters in Zechariah. All of us are sinful. All of us are unduly influenced by a favorite commentator, a favorite preacher, by the flavor of our own day. And so don't be too dogmatic. Chapter 14 is the final verse of the song of God's victory over history. You'll see Revelation 11:15. The kingdom of this world has become the kingdom of our God and of his Christ, and they shall reign forever. Whew! Well, that'll light you up. Now, chapters 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 have been very messianic. But chapter 14 is more God the Father oriented. Now, the titles from God are transferred to the Son, so I agree there's some fluidity there. And one thing I want to say. This chapter is apocalyptic. It's symbolic language. The ancient Israeli capital is used to foreshadow end time a fellowship with God. With that in mind, let's go to the text if we could then. Chapter 14, verse 1. Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. It's talking about instead of them being cast out, they're going to be the victors. They're going to be the ones to have the spoil. Look at verse 2. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem. Now, that has been an event that we've been looking at since way back here in Joel chapter 3. Remember in Joel 3, all the scriptures I gave you a few weeks ago, we were studying Joel, Isaiah 8, 9, and 10, Isaiah 17, 12 through 14, the book of Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39, Joel 3, 9 through 17, Revelation 16, 14 through 16, Revelation 19, 17 through 19. I've been amazed at how Joel chapters 2 and 3 fit in with Zechariah 12 through 14. Now, so here's all these nations gathered together for an end time conflict to battle, and the city will be captured. Now, this "will be captured" seems to relate, if you look just back on the other page, to chapter 13:8, where it talks about two-thirds will perish, but one-third will be saved. The remnant idea. And so this seems to be the one-third mentioned here. Look at verse 3. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against the nations. Boy, here is God as warrior. Matter of fact, you know that beautiful passage in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 18? If you'll look in your margin there, you'll see that goes back to an Old Testament passage where God is depicted as warrior. Now, we see God as warrior very clearly in two places in the Bible. Number one is the Exodus from Egypt, and number two is the conquest of the Promised Land. Now, that metaphor is used again for God fighting on behalf of His people in this ultimate confrontation between evil and good in an earthly setting. Now, notice where it says, as He fights on the day of battle. Notice again, and in that day His feet will stand. Now, this seems to refer to God, Yahweh, but we're in a messianic context, and we can't be real certain about that. Notice it mentions will stand the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives will be split in the middle from east to west by a very large valley. Now, I want you to know that the Mount of Olives runs from north to south. It's a high ridge, okay? Bethany is on that ridge, so it's a long ridge, several miles long. What this seems to imply is that it's going to split, and there's going to be a valley made right in front of the eastern gate in Jerusalem. Now, it's going to be a valley for two things: let God come and fight for His people, and number two, let His people escape the fighting. And that seems to be what we're talking about here. Now, the Masoretic text number 5, and I want you to drop down a minute to that, because there's some problems here in the text. So if you have several translations with you, you might want to open them this chapter. Notice mine says, and you will flee by the valley of my mountains. Now, you will flee is the Masoretic text. Now, the Peshitta and the Vulgate also have you will flee. The word flee, if you look at your translation, occurs in verse 5 three different times. Now, some ancient translations, for what reason I'm not sure, translate the word flee differently. Now, if you'll look at the Septuagint, which follows the Targums, and later another translation of the Hebrew into Greek, S-Y-A-M-M-A-C-H-U-S, Symmachus, also has that they will be stopped. Not they will flee by my valley, but they'll be stopped by my mountains, the valley of my mountains. So one sees it a cutoff, the other sees it a way of escape. And I think it's the way of escape. Now, RSV sees it a cutoff, but I really don't think that that'll hold water at all. Some see Mark 11:23, cast this mountain in the sea, as relating to this passage, possibly. I'm not sure. Notice where it says, for the valley of the mountains will reach Azel. Now, some have asserted this is possibly the city that's mentioned in Micah chapter 1, verse 11, but we're not sure. But it's obviously to the east, and it's where the terminus of this supernatural valley comes from. Yes, and you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah. Now, of course, Uzziah was the godly king during when Isaiah was called. He died and Isaiah was called. Now, this was referred to, we think, in Amos chapter 1, verse 1. Does that mean that a natural earthquake is what's going to split this ridge of mountains, the Mount of Olives? Well, it could be. God has often used natural means with supernatural timing. The Red Sea was split, but an east wind blew all night to dry the ground. The priests got in the Jordan River with the Ark of the Covenant, but an earthquake, an avalanche upstream dammed the water till they all got across. So God has often used natural things. Harnets fought His battle, but they were directed only at the enemy. That may be here that an earthquake is going to cause this. Now, notice it says, then the Lord, O my God, will come, and all the holy ones with Him. Now, all the holy ones is the idea of angels. We see this again back in Joel chapter 3 again. And that chapter has so many parallels. Notice the different places in the Bible where it talks about angels coming with the Messiah. Now, I think Joel 3:11 is one of those. Here are the other ones. By the way, before I do that, 2 Kings 6:16-17 shows there is an invisible army. Remember when Elisha's servant was so upset, Elisha said, "Oh, I pray God you'd open his eyes," and he saw the horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Friends, God's got an angelic army. Here's some other places you see it. Deuteronomy 33, verses 2 and 3. Matthew 16:27, Matthew 25:31, Mark 8:31, 2 Thessalonians 1:7, and Revelation 19:14. And that's the idea of holy ones. Now, my New American Standard has "with him," but the Masoretic text has "with thee," which seems to be God and someone else. You might want to see Acts 1:11 for possibly a parallel about Jesus being taken up and coming back the same way. Verse 6. "And it will come about in that day there will be no light." Now, what does that mean, no light? Well, this is one of those apocalyptic passages. Now, mine has, "and the luminaries will dwindle." Now, there's two things I want to say. Number one, this idea of nature convulsing at the presence and coming of God is a very common biblical theme. We see it in Isaiah 13:10, Isaiah 24:23, Jeremiah 4:23, Ezekiel 32:7 and 8, Joel 2:30 and 31, Acts 2:16 and 19, and Matthew 24:29. Now, it's very unusual. Mine has "the luminaries will dwindle," but the Septuagint and the Vulgate and even the NIV translate this "the no cold and ice." No cold and ice. I've mentioned this book several times to you, this 26 translations of the Old Testament, which is so helpful sometimes in difficult passages like this. And when we come and look, listen to these. This is King James. "And it shall come to pass on that day that the light shall not be clear nor dark." That doesn't make much sense. Listen to this one. "Light there shall be none that day. All shall be frost and cold." It's a Knox translation. "On that day there shall be neither heat nor cold nor frost." New English Bible. "In that day there shall be no light, but cold and freezing. And it shall come to pass in that day there shall be no light. The bright stars shall be withdrawn." Now, I think that "the bright stars shall be withdrawn" is what it's talking about. There's going to be a lowering of the intensity of these heavenly bodies. But as you can tell, there's wide variety of translations. Now, look at this. "For it will be," verse 8, "it will be a unique day which is known to the Lord." Could that be an allusion to Matthew 24:36 about only God the Father knows when Jesus is coming back? It may be. Or it may be a unique day known to the Messiah. But we're in a context of God the Father here. "Neither day nor night, but it will come about that at evening time there will be light." Oh, you know what? Some of the most beautiful prophecies, not only in the book of the Revelation, but in Isaiah, talk about that in the end time there'll be no sun or moon because God will be in our midst and His radiance and glory will provide light for the entire New Jerusalem. Watch these. Oh, you'll like to look these up. Isaiah 60:19-20, Revelation 21:25, Revelation 22:5. God will be light. There'll be no light. We're in an end time setting. Oh, what a wonderful place. "And it shall come about in that day that the living waters will flow from Jerusalem." Now, this idea of living waters is another very important eschatological theme. Matter of fact, you remember Revelation 21 and 22, a stream flows out from God's throne, and all these different trees of life bearing fruit year-round are by that stream. The idea of the early in the Psalms about a man planted by the rivers of water, it's the idea about a righteousness and symbolized by a river, and which was a great blessing for a desert people. Even when Jesus said, "I am the living water," at the Feast of Tabernacles, booths, in John 7:38, John 4:10-14, this may be a reference, this living water. Let me give you a few other Old Testament passages of where it's used. Ezekiel 47:1-12, Joel 3:18, there's that parallel of Joel 3 again, and Revelation 22:1-2, living waters. "Half of them toward the eastern sea," the Dead Sea, by the way, it'll make it alive, "and half of them toward the western sea," which, of course, is the Mediterranean Sea. "It will be in summer as well as in winter." It won't be a stream that's connected with the seasons. It'll be a perpetual stream. It'll flow from God. It's like that river of living water in John 4, flowing up out of a person who has the Holy Spirit. That water will never dry up. in Palestine only two seasons, hot and cold, and sometimes the streams dried up in the summer. This stream will flow and continue to flow. Now, and the Lord will be king over all the earth. Now, back in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 7, and 1 Samuel 12:12, we see that God, Yahweh, was meant to be king. But his people asked for an earthly king because Samuel's sons were evil and they were worried about the leadership to come. So God let them be an example or a representative of a heavenly king. Now, let's look for a moment and the Lord's Prayer, Matthew 6:10, where he prays, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." He's praying for the kingdom of God to come, and God is king. Notice it's a universal kingdom over all the earth. Wow. And the Lord will be the only one, and his name will be the only one. Here is an emphasis on the oneness of God, monotheism, the great prayer, the Shema of the synagogue, Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 6, is now, there's no idols, only God. Look at verse 10, "And the land will be changed into a plain." Now, this idea of the land supernaturally changed, there have been several theories. Let me show some of them to you. Number one, some say it's a theological symbol of the holiness of God that dwells in Jerusalem, so it's geographically higher. Some have said it provides access for all the world to come to God. Some have said it's an agricultural watershed kind of thing, that the water will flow to all the peoples evenly. Some say it's connected to Isaiah chapter 40, verse 4. And you might want to look up that parallel about how when the Lord comes, there'll be some changes in the terrain. Now, notice where it says, "from Geba." Now, we're not sure where that is. That means height. Many assume it's a town about 6 miles north of Jerusalem, mentioned in 2 Kings 23:8. "To Rimmon, south of Jerusalem, but Jerusalem will rise and remain on its site from Benjamin's gates." Now, all of these gates and towers, we're not real sure where they are anymore. But it's obvious we're speaking of the whole city of David being lifted up. And, of course, that's the Jews always talk about going up to Jerusalem, even when there are some higher geographical points, topological points. It's a theological sense. Now, notice where it mentions verse 11. "And the people will live in it, and there will be no more curse." Well, there have been several questions about what does this curse mean. Is it the curse of Genesis 3:17, where all creation is cursed? Or is it the curse of Deuteronomy 28, connected with the covenant blessings? Or is it the curse of Zechariah 8:13, connected with the exile? Well, I don't know. But it sure parallels Revelation 22:3, when there will be no more curse. There'll be no more sea. People can approach God. And, of course, that's the main thrust of the verse just before this, that everybody will have access to God. "For Jerusalem will dwell in security." And, again, I saw a parallel in Joel 3:20, where it promised that Jerusalem would be secure forever. Now, in verse 12, "And now this will be the plague which the Lord will strike all the peoples who have gone to war against Jerusalem." Now, the plague here, many see this as an allusion to the Assyrian king Sennacherib's invasion of Judah and his siege of Jerusalem, when God, through the death angel, killed 600,000 of them in one night and spared the city under Hezekiah. You might want to see Isaiah 37:36 and 2 Kings 19:35. The latter part of verse 12, some have seen as speaking of nuclear war. But I think we're reading too much of our day into this when we do that. Now, verse 13. "And it will come about on that day, a great panic from the Lord will fall on them, and they will seize one of his hand, and the hand of one will be lifted against the hand of another." Many times in the Old Testament, God won the battles for his people by causing confusion in the camp of the enemy. That's what happened to Gideon. Let me give you several references. Judges 7:22, 1 Samuel 14:15 through 20, and 2 Chronicles 20:22 and 23. "And Judah will also fight at Jerusalem." Now, here's another problem of translation. The NIV has "at Jerusalem," but the RSV has "against Jerusalem." Now, I really think the RSV, from the context, that's an obvious mistranslation. It's not that Judah will fight against Jerusalem, but that Judah will fight at Jerusalem. Judah will be united with the people of the city to fight. And that's the thrust here, I think. Okay. And so also, like this plague, will be a plague on the horse, the mule, the camel, the donkey, and all the cattle that will be in those camps. Well, now, of course, this is the mode of transportation and load-bearing. So it's like God's going to stop this enemy army, pagans, from fleeing and also from taking away the spoils. So the spoils are going to stay, and the enemy is going to have to stay and be destroyed. Now, not all of them are going to be destroyed, but the majority will, because look in verse 16. And it will come about that any who is left of all of the nations who went against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths. Well, that tells me that all of them will not be killed. The large number will. It also tells me the remnants of this Gentile army is going to be converted and worship God. There's even possibly a parallel in Isaiah 66, 19 through 24. Now look at the next one. By the way, God is king again. You might want to see verse 9. Now for the Feast of Booths, you may want to go back and look at the original meaning of this in Leviticus 23, 34 through 44. It was basically a feast for thank God for the harvest and committing the harvest to Him. It was a reading of the law. We see from Nehemiah 8, 14 through 18. John 7, this feast is where Jesus stood up and said, I am the living water. And there was a ritual where the priest went to the Pool of Siloam and got some pitchers of water and poured them over the altar. And right then, I think, Jesus stood and said, I am the living water. Boy, what a powerful, powerful truth symbolized in this ritual, in this feast. Look at verse 17. And it will be that whenever the families of the earth does not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts. Now, this Lord of hosts, remember that post-exilic title, emphasizing the militaristic aspect of God, the captain of the armies of heaven. I remember Martin Luther's hymn, A Mighty Fortress, when it says, Lord Sabaoth, his name. Well, that Sabaoth or Sabaoth is this Lord of hosts. I used to think they were saying Lord Sabaoth funny. And there'll be no rain on them. Now, this no rain is again related to the cursing and blessing section of Deuteronomy 27 and 28. Now, Deuteronomy is Moses on the plains of Moab preaching to prepare the people to enter the land. Joshua fulfilled this when he entered the land as he split the Levitical singers, one up on Mount Gerizim, some on Mount Ebal. One had the blessings, one had the cursings. Now, this cursing about no rain is Deuteronomy 28, 22 through 24. It's like the whole world's been converted. There's a few renegades here and there, and those who do rebel will have no rain. And that's the idea. They're part of the covenant blessings now, and they're going to be a part of the covenant cursings if they don't do what they're supposed to do. And the families of Egypt do not go up. Now, I think Egypt here is used as a traditional enemy of the people of God, not just literal Egypt, but symbolic of all the Gentiles who were against God's people. And a plague which the Lord smites the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. Everybody's supposed to be converted and take part of the covenant. If they don't come, which is one of the requirements of the Jews, they had to come to these major feast days if they live within so far. Now all are expected to come from all over the world to show God is king and God is victor and God is in control of his world. And this will be the punishment of Egypt and it punishment of all the nations who do not go to celebrate the Feast of Booths. On that day there will be inscribed on the bells of the horses, Holy to the Lord. Now, that holy to the Lord was what was originally on the mitre of the high priest. You might want to see Exodus 28:36. And we learn from Zechariah 3:9, it's going to be on the headband of the eschatological high priest. And so here we have the whole community being holy unto the Lord, the whole world. Notice what it says. They're going to be on the bells of the horses. And the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like the bowls before the altar, and every cooking pot in Jerusalem and in Judah will be holy to the Lord of hosts. Well, what that's saying is here are different levels of Hebrew society. The horses, load bearers, military, the cooking pots in the Lord's house, the cooking pots in the rest of the nation. So it shows that even the mundane or military, everything is holy to the Lord. And this is so important because I think in modern America, we sometimes emphasize secular versus sacred. I want to tell you, all of life belongs to God. All days belong to God. All earth belongs to God. And that's the ideal, I believe, symbolized here. And all who sacrifice will come to them and boil in them, and they'll no longer be. Now, look at your translation in verse 21. Do you have the word Canaanite? Now, Canaanite, there shouldn't be any Canaanites left, which was a symbol of pagans. Everybody's supposed to be converted. Now, there'll be a few who don't come to the feast, but God will put on them the cursings of the covenant blessing, Deuteronomy 28. Now, what is this idea about a Canaanite? Well, many times the translation of this word Canaanite is the word merchant. And I think merchant fits better here. Merchant in the house of the Lord of hosts in that day. Now, we know from the New Testament, this is the way they use the word Canaanite for merchant. We know that Jesus cleansed the temple several times, these merchants. So what it's going to say in this eschatological setting, there's going to be no ripoff, either in business or in the church. That's the idea. Now, you might want to see Matthew 21, 12 through 13, where this word Canaanite is used for a merchant. Now, it's possible it's used for an unholy person, but context militates against it. Well, boy, hadn't this been an exciting chapter? God's finally vindicated in history. It seems to me the only purpose for the millennium is for God, whose people have been hurt and abused in history, to show his victory in history. And I can't understand any other place for it. The ideal about an end-time battle. And, of course, John develops this theme into the idea of Armageddon, after a period of peace. It may be the idea of man in a perfect environment, even in the presence of Messiah, and he's still going to rebel, which shows that man has a bent toward evil, even in a perfect environment. It may be God vindicating himself in history. I'm not sure of all the reasons here, but I want to tell you this. God's in control of history. History is moving toward a nexus or a focus, and God is going to come out on top. Friends, I read the last chapter of the book. And the last chapter of the book is even better than the last chapter of Zechariah. And it's a humdinger. God's in control. God's on his throne. Trust him. He is able. The God who is able is going to bring it about. Hallelujah. Well, I hope you enjoyed the book of Zechariah. And I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.